It's my privilege to introduce our speaker for the day. He's Mr. Wilmot Urban. By vocation, he's a lawyer in the area of civil litigation, married to his wife Jeannie. They have three grown children. He's had some measure of visibility in our church life recently. He was the chairman of our most recent pastoral search committee. Had some chance to speak publicly for us in that setting. But his reason to be here today is that he is by, I think the right word is avocation, an author. He's authored several books. I think John Grisham was a lawyer once who had an avocation of being an author, and he's done okay. I think I was looking up the definition of avocation. It's somewhere between being a hobby and a vocation. I guess it's a very serious interest that sometimes turns into more than that for some people. But out of his love for writing, he's going to come share with us today about how the Christian faith and his joy and love of writing intermix. So, Wilmot, please come share with us.
Thanks, Neil. Buddy DeBose did remind me that I've already spoken too much over the last month, and so I promise I'm not going to speak long, and if I do, he's going to raise his hand and stop me. So I'll... Is this working? It is working. Okay. When Neil called and asked me to speak about the topic today, which is the intersection of faith and writing, I was thrilled to do that because it really is one of my favorite topics. And for Neil, is this too loud? Is that gonna? Oh, okay. If any of you have had the misfortune of reading any of my books, you know that it is one of my favorite topics because most of my books relate to family relationships and to faith. Sometimes my short stories get a little off course, but my novels, for the most part, have stuck to those themes. As I sat down last weekend and thought about what I wanted to say today about faith and Christianity and writing, I felt compelled to think about the scriptures first. And fortunately, I didn't have to go far in the scriptures to find what I thought were the fundamental principles for me to talk about today. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, that is a verse that is packed with meaning. And Neil or Dr. DeWitt or any of our fine teachers and preachers could write hundreds of pages about that one verse and speak for hours. I'm not going to do that today. My interest in that verse today is the word created. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And we see in Genesis chapter 1 the creation story unfold for us, culminating in verse 26 of chapter 1, where God created man in his image. And then in repetition, and I believe for emphasis, in his image, he created man. Now, what in the world does that have to do with what I want to talk about today? I think it demonstrates to me, and I hope to you, that one of God's characteristics is creativity. God created this universe and everything in it. He is a creative God, and he has made man in his image. And I believe that it follows from those verses, from a reading of that chapter, that God intended to give man certain characteristics of his own. And that's what I want to talk about today, because I believe that creativity is a characteristic of God that he has given in some measure to each one of us. Now, we don't possess all of the characteristics of God, obviously. We're not deity. We are not omnipotent. We're not omnipresent. My wife can certainly confirm to you that we're not holy or righteous, particularly in our own nature. There are many characteristics of God that we don't have. But then as you look at, for example, the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. Did I leave one out, Dick? I may have. But God has given, I believe, man a measure of each one of those characteristics. And by the same token, he has given to each one of us the characteristic of creativity. Now, what does this have to do with my topic today? Creativity, as I said, is a godly characteristic given to man. The ability to paint, to form a pot out of clay, to chisel a statue from a block of stone, to sing, to write music, to dance. All of those things are creative characteristics that we possess in one form or another. Now, as with any gift, we can misuse a gift that God gives us. We can misuse one of those characteristics, like love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. And we can misuse creativity. And whether the creativity that God has given me or to you, no matter what that might be, is being misused, I think can be determined by a pretty simple litmus test. And that litmus test is this. Is the creative work that I am doing bringing glory to God? Or said another way, is it honoring God? And if it is, I'm using that creativity, that gift from God, rightly. If it is not honoring God, and if it is not bringing glory to God, then I'm misusing that gift that God has given me. In 1 Corinthians 10:31, we read, "Whatever you do, do all to the glory of God." And I think that's that litmus test. And that's that question that I need to ask myself every morning when I wake up and I'm going to do some writing. Does my writing that I'm doing today bring glory to God? Does it honor God? That's the question I need to ask myself every morning when I get up and use that gift of creativity that God has given to me. Now, let me tell you just a little bit about me so you'll know who I am and kind of how I got here on what I think is really has been a great adventure, not only in my life, but in the life of my entire family, and that is beginning to write fiction starting 6 or 8 years ago. I owe a great debt of gratitude to my father, who was not a writer of fiction, but who taught me as a child to love to read and to love to learn from reading and to love books. And he very patiently but determinedly instilled that in me, and I owe him a great deal for that. But I owe thanks to God for giving me the creative gift of writing. If my father had wanted to teach me to play the trumpet, he never had succeeded in doing that. He could not, our parents cannot give us the gift of creativity. I believe that comes from God. And writing is the is one of those gifts that comes with creativity. Now, I'm a lawyer by trade, as Neil told you, and I have spent a lot of my time writing legal papers, briefs, and memoranda, and opinions, and this kind of boring stuff that is, I guess, sometimes not boring to us lawyers, but to most others is boring, is nonfiction. A judge who is a friend of mine, who I've known for many years and practiced in front of, happened to read one of my early novels. And I had the occasion to be in his chambers one day, and he told me that he had read the book. And he said, "Mr. Irvin, you know, I've been reading your fiction for many, many years." And he was talking about the factual summations that went into my briefs. And so I suppose that in some way my legal training helped me in learning how to write fiction. When I graduated from law school, I had a marvelous experience of clerking for two different judges. The first one was Chief Justice George Gregory from Chester, and he was the Chief Justice of the South Carolina Supreme Court. He was a wise and humble and Christian man who taught me that you could be a lawyer and you could be a Christian too. And I know that many of you think that's an oxymoron, and it may be. But at any rate, Judge Gregory began to teach me how to write, and he had a particular style, and that style was terse. And he never used a word in an opinion that wasn't necessary to deliver the opinion of the court. And I can remember spending days and days drafting opinions for the judge to consider. And then we would sit down together at his conference table, and he would very calmly and patiently take out his black felt pen, and he would go through my draft of the opinion, and he would scratch out mostly adjectives, and he would get the opinion down to the form that he wanted it to be. And I learned a great deal from that. At the time, I didn't realize it, but God was giving me a training ground for my future writing by giving me this marvelous teacher to show me how to write in a style that I found to be difficult but very effective. Now, the next year, I had the opportunity to clerk for senior federal judge Robert Hemphill. Some of you may remember Judge Hemphill. A wonderful person, but his writing style happened to be the exact opposite of that of Chief Justice Gregory. Judge Hemphill, like most federal judges, liked to write long, long opinions with many citations, and every word has to have at least 12 or 14 characters in it, and it's just a different style. I had been with Judge Hemphill about 3 months, and a famous murder trial, the rape and murder of a young girl here in Richland County, had been decided in the state court, and the death sentence had been imposed, and the case came to Judge Hemphill on what we call habeas corpus. Judge Hemphill and I read the record of, I guess, about a 7-week trial in which a state court jury convicted the defendant in that case, and the state court judge sentenced him to death. It was our job on habeas corpus to review the record and to make a decision as to whether that decision was correct under federal law. Well, Judge Hemphill, after reviewing the record, looked at me and he said, "Moose, he called me Moose, and I'll never ever tell anybody why, but at any rate, he said, "Moose, I want you to write an opinion that I'll be proud of, and I want you to deny that habeas corpus petition." Well, I spent weeks writing. Thank you.
Get in my pocket. All right, I'll do that.
I'm sorry for that. I spent weeks writing that opinion, and the first draft of it I took to Judge Hemphill was totally unacceptable. It wasn't long enough. It wasn't good enough. And so I went back and tried again. I think on the third draft of the opinion that I took to him, he accepted it. Now, that opinion was later affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court, but on its route to the U.S. Supreme Court, it has to go back to the South Carolina Supreme Court, to my old boss, Chief Justice Gregory, who wrote in a very terse style. I was scared to death because Judge Gregory knew that I was the law clerk to Judge Hemphill because Judge Gregory helped me get the job. And so the opinion went back to the South Carolina Supreme Court, and of course the conclusion was the same. The South Carolina Supreme Court had affirmed the conviction, just as Judge Hemphill had done in the federal court, but the style was a little different, and I worried for days. I would sit in my office and just, I could visualize the wincing expression on Judge Gregory's face as he read this lengthy opinion. The first paragraph of Judge Hemphill's opinion went on, it was one sentence, it went on for two typewritten pages and it had 11 footnotes. Now, Judge Gregory would never have accepted that, but at any rate, again, another part of my life experience that I had no idea was building for me a foundation about how to write. I'm going to try to get a little quicker here because I know everybody has to go. Something else happened in my life after law school that I think was as important as the legal training that I had in writing, and I was an English major, and I love to write and I love to read, but I'd never written any fiction. Well, my wife and I moved back to Columbia, and we quickly had three children, and over a course of a few years, and we decided that we would move them to the country, which was, I think, probably the most important decision that we made as a couple. Aside from the decision to get married. And we moved, as William knows, our youngsters out to the country, and we raised them up out there, and I found myself doing things like building pig pens and chicken coops and spending my Saturday morning doing all kinds of things with my children that I never dreamed that I would do. But all of that time I was building in my mind experiences that I would later use in writing fiction. I'll never forget the day our youngest child, Ruthie, killed her first deer. Ruthie was about 15 years old, and her older brother had been hunting for years, and Ruthie was bound and determined. If you know Ruthie, she's bound and determined for everything, that she wanted to kill a deer. I said, okay, that's what we got these deer stands for out here. If you want to hunt, we'll hunt. I gave her a brief lesson on how to use the rifle. And if you've ever been deer hunting, you know that you get up in this tripod stand that only has one seat, and it's not very comfortable, and really it's only suitable for one person. But I got up in the stand with Ruthie. And Ruthie was sitting in the chair, and I had my arms around her, and I had told her about how to hold that rifle butt firm against her shoulder and to sight down that rifle and look through that scope. And if she saw that deer, to put the crosshairs of that scope right on the shoulder of that deer, and then just to gently squeeze the trigger. Don't jerk it, just gently squeeze it. Well, we'd been through all that. We're sitting in the deer stand. It's beginning to rain. About an hour has gone by, and I'm ready to go back home. Just about that time, the most beautiful doe you have ever seen walked out into the roadway, and she must not have been 30 yards from where our deer stand was. And I could feel Ruthie's excitement. And I said, Ruthie, are you sure you want to do this? And she said, yes. And I remember looking down that rifle barrel and looking through that scope, and she had those crosshairs of that scope right on the shoulder of that doe. And if you've ever killed a deer, you know that it is a mixture of excitement and remorse like nothing else. You are killing a beautiful animal, but it is an exciting thing to do. Well, Ruthie pulled that trigger just like I had told her to, and bam, that doe went down just like that, dead as a hammer. And I thought Ruthie's heart was going to come out of her throat. She was so excited about what had happened. And so we went through the ritual of the first deer kill, and we bloodied her face, and we took the deer to be processed, and we had a marvelous, marvelous day. And it was just one of those amazing times that I think back on, and that crept into, not exactly as I've told it, but it was one of those experiences that crept into the creative process that began to develop. I woke up one morning and said, I want to write a novel. And I sat down and began to do that. And the thing that amazes me the most about writing, and I am going to get to writing and faith eventually. Give me just a couple of more minutes. The thing about the process of writing fiction is that it writes itself. It sort of jumps from the subconscious onto the page. Now, when you write a piece of nonfiction, you sit down and organize the book, and you decide what the chapters are going to be and what it is you're going to write about. Well, when you write fiction, it's not like that at all. You have a germ of an idea of what you want to write, and then you sit down and you begin to write, and the process takes hold, and the story begins to write itself. Now, before you think that I'm too crazy on that subject, I want to read to you very briefly a part of an essay who was written by, I think, a brilliant Southern writer whose name is Flannery O'Connor. Some of you may know her. Her short stories are just amazing. And she is a wonderful fiction writer. Well, one of my children gave me this little essay to read, and I want to read you a part of it, because when I read it, it resonated with me so much about the process of writing fiction. This is what Flannery O'Connor says about writing a short story she wrote called Good Country People. I wrote a story once called Good Country People, in which a lady PhD has her wooden leg stolen by a Bible salesman whom she has tried to seduce. Now, I'll admit that paraphrased in this way, the situation is simply a low joke. The average reader is pleased to observe anybody's wooden leg being stolen, but without ceasing to appeal to him and without making any statements of high intention, this story does manage to operate at another level of experience by letting the wooden leg accumulate meaning. Now, a little might be said about the way in which this happens. I wouldn't want you to think that in that story, I sat down and said, I'm now going to write a story about a PhD with a wooden leg, using the wooden leg as a symbol for another kind of affliction. I doubt myself if many fiction writers know what they are going to do when they start out. When I started writing that story, I didn't know there was going to be a PhD with a wooden leg in it. I merely found myself one morning writing a description of two women that I knew something about. And before I realized it, I had equipped one of them with a daughter with a wooden leg. As the story progressed, I brought in the Bible salesman, but I had no idea what I was going to do with him. I didn't know he was going to steal that wooden leg until 10 or 12 lines before he did it. But when I found out that this was what was going to happen, I realized that it was inevitable. This is a story that produces a shock for the reader. And I think one reason for this is that it produced a shock for the writer. And so that tells you that somebody besides me, anyway, who's been published, kind of thinks the same way about writing fiction. Let me wrap up by telling you two little stories that are true. And I think the first one illustrates how God confirms the creative work that we do in our lives, like writing for me. And the second one will demonstrate how novels get published and how budding authors like me get frustrated but blessed in the process. Now, let me say by way of footnote that I have never characterized my novels as Christian fiction, and I have never characterized myself as a Christian author. There are plenty of writers of fiction out there who do both, and I have no criticism of that whatsoever. It's just that I simply prefer myself to say that I am a writer of fiction who happens to be a Christian. And I hope that my novels reflect the faith that I have in the stories that I tell. Now, I think throughout the course of great literature, so many writers that we all know their names and have read plenty of their books have been Christians. But they didn't necessarily say, I'm a Christian writer or I'm a Christian author. They were a writer. They were a novelist. But their faith in Christ came out in the books and the stories that we read. And so that may be semantics. It may be a point that's not worth mentioning, but it would be similar to someone calling themselves a Christian architect or a Christian plumber. I'm a writer, but I'm a Christian. And I hope that comes out in what I write and of what you read. Now the little stories, and we'll quit. God is amazing to me how He confirms what we're up to sometimes. I wonder if you've ever had that experience. Now, when I published my first novel, Jack's Passage, I took a copy of the book to a man who had been a great encourager of mine and a great friend to me, and his name is Professor Matthew Brookley. He is a world-class F. Scott Fitzgerald scholar. He probably is the world-class F. Scott Fitzgerald scholar, and he ended up at the University of South Carolina. He's made significant contributions to the University of South Carolina, and for reasons that I won't go into, he was kind enough to read my first book. He was also kind enough to write a letter to me that was complimentary and stretched the truth quite a bit about what he had to say about it. But that letter meant a great deal to me. I'll never forget receiving it in my office and reading that letter and treasuring it. And I folded it up, and I put it in my pocket, and I was going to take it home that night. And I did. And when I got home, it just so happened that my daughter, Mary Bryce, had come home for the weekend from her freshman year at Wofford College. And she came to me, and she said, Dad, I brought this book I've been telling you about that we've been reading in English class. She was a freshman. That I like so much, and I think you'll like the stories so much. And I thought, here, I thought you'd like to read some of these stories. And I said, great. And I looked down, and the book was The Short Stories of F. Scott Fitzgerald, the premier collection, the premier edition that was compiled by none other than Professor Matthew Brookley. That book is used in undergraduate English classes all over the world. Well, I took the letter out of my pocket and I handed it to Mary Bryce. And she opened up the letter and she read the letter and she saw that it was written by Matthew Brookley. And she made the connection to the book that she had enjoyed reading that happened to have been compiled by Matthew Brookley. Now, that was a little epiphany for us. And Mary Bryce and I have never forgotten that. And I think about it often, and it inspires me often as I write. It's something that I like to think about when I say, I don't believe in coincidences. I believe in the sovereignty of God. And I think that little epiphany is an example of God's working in my life with one of my children to encourage me to continue to write. One other little story. Publishing. The publishing world is a very closed society. If you've ever tried to get a book published, you know that it is a very difficult thing to do. Right, Key? It's hard to break through. you've done a lot better than I have. You know, when I wrote my first book, my first novel, I didn't know what to do with it, really. I sort of set it up on the shelf, and then I finally got the courage to have my children and my wife read it, and then I didn't know what to do with it. And so it just sort of sat around, and I began to write another one, I finally bit the bullet, and I said, okay, I'm going to write some publishing companies, and I'm going to see about getting my book published. And so I did that. Well, I'll tell you a little secret. In every New York publishing company, there is something called the slush pile. And it usually is located in the basement of the building of the publishing house. And when you submit an unsolicited manuscript to a New York publishing house, it goes in the slush pile. It's not read. They don't have time to. They don't have the people to do it. They get hundreds of thousands of unsolicited manuscripts. And unless you have an agent that can break you in, your manuscript's going to go down in the basement in the slush pile. Well, I received my fair share of rejection slips that were courteous enough from these New York publishing companies, and I decided to send one of my manuscripts to a regional publishing company, and I won't identify that company. It's a very, very well thought of publishing company. And it just happens to be located right next to a major southern university. And in the course of that publishing house's work, it utilizes undergraduate English majors at that southern university as what they call readers. Those undergraduate English students, English majors, will read these unsolicited manuscripts and they'll write some notes about it and they'll make a recommendation that'll get sent up to the editors as to whether that the book ought to be accepted or rejected or further read by somebody higher up the food chain. Well, that happened with my manuscript, and on a particular day, I got returned to me my manuscript. And there was a very, very polite and kind cover letter from the senior editor of the publishing house that said, thank you so very much for sending this book, and best of luck to you, and so forth and so on. Well, what the editor didn't realize when the book got sent back to me is that the reader, the undergraduate English major's notes were still slipped into the manuscript. They hadn't been removed when they sent me back my manuscript. I remember to this day the exact wording of those notes written by that undergraduate English major to the editor of the publishing company recommending the rejection of my manuscript. And those notes said, pure Christian propaganda, not suitable for our audience of readers. Now, my first reaction was I was furious. I was just furious that this would have been rejected on that basis. And then after I had a cup of coffee and I was able to think through it, I put things in perspective and I realized what a wonderful compliment I had just received. I had just been blessed. I mean, didn't Jesus say, "Blessed are you when men cast insults at you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me"? That's Matthew 5:11. And didn't Jesus say, "Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven"? Matthew 5:10, the Beatitudes. And so I said to myself, wow, I have just been blessed by my Lord because of the stand I had taken for Him in not omitting my faith from my writing. And here some undergraduate student in Chapel Hill has decided that it's Christian propaganda and it shouldn't be published. And I believe that to be God's sovereignty as well, that my book shouldn't have been published by that. It was about 2 weeks later, I was shaving and getting ready to go to work, and I was listening to the NPR news broadcast in the mornings, and they were interviewing this guy who had been in the publishing business forever. And he was talking about how dissatisfied he was with it and how he had decided to open up a little storefront publishing company in Charleston, South Carolina, and that he was hungry for authors. Well, Jeannie and I called him that day, made an appointment, drove to Charleston the following Friday, spent a half a day with him, and within a matter of weeks, I had signed on with his little company, and I published 4 novels through his little company, which now, by the way, has been gobbled up by Amazon.com. And so I'm no longer an important person to him. I'm just one of a gazillion. But that little part of, I guess, my adventure taught me something, too. And that is that my writing is under the sovereignty of God, and things will work out the way He wants them to work out. Finish with this. I don't like to use the word never. And the older I get, the more I realize how often I'm wrong and how many mistakes I make. And for me to say as a Christian that I would never do this or I would never do that is a scary statement. Let him who think he stands take heed lest he falls. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12. But I hope and pray today that I will never be ashamed that my writing and my faith are inextricably woven together. God gave me the gift of creativity in writing, and I believe He expects me to use that writing to His glory and to His honor. And that's what writing and Christianity are all about. Thank you for letting me share with you today.